General George Custer didn't hate the Native Americans he massacred. He even admired them.
Custer admired that life. They would take a campaign out, and he would be gone for months living in the wilderness. So he felt like real kinship with them. I mean, he said he had never seen such incredible mastery. The warriors, you know, what incredible soldiers they were and how they rode a horse. He said, if I had a regiment of soldiers as good as they, I could win anything.
That's novelist Tatiana Soli. We talk with her about her new novel, The Removes. General Custer figures as one of the main characters. Then we dig up our interview from 2005 with Charles Mann about his acclaimed study of the Americas before Columbus, 1491. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Tatiana Soli's new novel, The Removes, takes a deep look into the complicated relationships between white settlers of the American West and the indigenous peoples they displaced. Those relationships were mediated by the so-called Indian Wars, where, after the Civil War, the U.S. government initiated the brutal push westward that dispossessed so many of the native inhabitants of their territory. Tribes fought each other. Some worked for the invader, and others attacked the white settlers and fought back against the U.S. cavalry. General George Custer was a Civil War hero when he was tasked with conquering the American West, an endeavor that resulted ultimately in his death at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. He's a key character in Soli's novel, The Removes, but the book focuses more on the story of two young women who find themselves experiencing life on two different sides in the Indian Wars. One is Custer's wife, Libby, who breaks with convention to follow her husband to the field of action. The other is Anne, captured at age 15 by the Cheyenne tribe, who, after enduring the brutalities meted out to captives, becomes integrated into the tribe. When she's finally rescued, she finds that she has no real place in either world, native or white, and must find her place within herself and those she loves. The Removes is a thrilling story, powerfully told, one that poses questions that have no easy answers. Tatiana Soli is a novelist and short story writer, with three previous novels, The Lotus Eaters, The Forgetting Tree, and The Last Good Paradise. Well, Tatiana Soli, welcome back to Writer's Voice. It's been quite a while.
It has been a while, yeah.
Yeah, we first spoke with you, about your first book, your debut novel, The Lotus Eaters. But now your latest, your fourth novel, The Removes. First, just tell us about the title.
I always, you know, sometimes you just stumble across the right thing. On this one, I was reading captivity narratives, and the first really famous one was the story, the narrative, the captivity of Mary Rowlandson, and she puts in her section, each is like the first remove, second remove, third remove, and it seemed a mysterious word, and she's talking about it in a religious context, you know, being taken away from her faith and all of this stuff, but I thought it just was interesting and mysterious, and it applies to Anne, who is the captive, but it also applies to Libby and to Custer even, so I just liked it. It kind of worked for me to be thinking in that term while I was writing the book.
And so, you know, as you've said, this is really about the Indian Wars, the wars of the settlers against the Indians as the West was being settled. The book opens with an epigraph by Crazy Horse saying, "A very great vision is needed, and the man who has it must follow it." You know, when I read that, I thought, who are you referring to? Are you referring to yourself as the author, or are you in some ironic sense referring to Custer?
I'm actually just referring to the lack of it. In the book, there is nobody that had that. So, you know, when I write historical fiction, I'm always thinking about it in a very contemporary way, and I try to write it that way, and I have the issues be that way. And so I just, when I included all the historical, like the little documents and everything, I think it's kind of shocking when you actually put yourself back in that time that nobody had any vision, and that's how it happened. It's not like everybody was, you know, they were intelligent people back then, but the ideas that were traveling around were just shocking, and to think that people had to act on it, you know. And even Custer, and we have this idea that Custer, like, was a crazy man. He wasn't a crazy man. He was a very practical man, and he was a soldier, but he had no ability to do anything than what he did, you know, other than if he had quit the army. But within the idea of what the government wanted, if they had not cheated and lied and constantly, you know, done the wrong thing, it at least you wouldn't have had the incredible brutality and just sadness that did go on. And so, you know, I mean, I always think about it in the contemporary context as not having somebody with a vision.
Could you say more about this? I mean, you know, what was done and, you know, kind of the outlines. I mean, the book has some, starts out, in fact, with quite a brutal scene. This is a scene of actually an Indian raid on a white family. You cover the brutality on both sides in great degree. And when I say both sides, I'm not acting like President Trump saying, oh, well, there's good people on both sides and bad people on both sides. But situate us within this moral universe and what was happening.
I mean, as obviously the U.S. Army was trying to get the Indians onto the reservations, and so, you know, they were supposed to surrender or they would be killed, you know, and a lot of times we didn't give them a chance to even move on. Not that we had any right to make them move on, but we didn't even give them that chance. It just seemed like we wanted to, you know, get rid of them. And a lot of the soldiers and a lot of the people that were out there, I mean, it was the Wild West, and, you know, they just, the cost of life, you know, was very low. And there were good people out there that were trying to get the government, but when they would send a letter, you know, to Washington, it would take 2 weeks to get back a response. And the response was from people who knew nothing about what was really going on the ground. So it was just a losing formula. And of course, the native tribes, I mean, they had encroachment, and they would get a treaty, and it would be lied about. And the only hope they had to do was to be threatening enough to try to roll back the progression of the settlers. And so just the threat of violence, you know, there were some towns, and I think I have one little scene in the book, there were some towns that were abandoned because the settlers were so scared of the danger that they went back east. And so basically that's what they wanted, and, you know, it was retaliation and revenge for incredible brutality. So I'm thinking of these characters, and I'm thinking, you know, what was it really like to go to be alive at that time, and what would you be afraid of? What would you and I be afraid of if we went out in a wagon there, you know? And so that's kind of where I'm coming from. I just wanted to create what it really was like, and it was really brutal from both sides. And that's basically, you know, the political leverage that people had was, you know, brutality and violence and killing each other.
Right. And was it really hard to write that, actually, those scenes?
It's really hard. It's really hard. You know, it's kind of a dark place. And so when, like on my first book, I mean, doing the research and everything, I think, you know, for me, it's something that I was very interested in. I always say it's so interesting when you go to schools and when you go to colleges, even colleges, that the students don't really, they just remember kind of like vague things from history, and they don't really have a feeling for what it was like. So to me, it's really important to have it visceral, and, you know, parts of it are unpleasant, and if you omit those parts, then you're not accurately reflecting what happened then, and so people aren't going to know it any better after reading my book. So that's my goal, and so, you know, I try to have scenes that are less violent, because it would be impossible otherwise, but I want to have that full journey, and so it's kind of like, you know, stuff that is necessary, important to have in there. And I'm always interested, you know, how do people overcome that kind of brutality? How do they survive it? That's always been a huge interest for me. So in a way, that's what my focus is on, is when you're writing these, you know, really horrific scenes, how does Anne, you know, keep on going? I mean, that's the interest in me and character.
Yeah, so now tell us about your main characters, starting with Anne, because she does begin the book, and there's also Libby Bacon, and let us not forget George Armstrong Custer, who you call Audie in the book.
Mm-hmm. Anne is basically, you know, a 15-year-old, and she has her settler family, so obviously, you know, she's out there, you know, not by choice, but she's there with her family, and so this horrific, the worst thing that you can imagine happens where she's losing her whole family, and she doesn't even understand the ideas that she has because, you know, like we're, the way we're brought up, and so obviously she's taught to fear the native tribes, and, you know, they have to be careful because, you know, there is a lot of violence out there, and so then when she does lose her family and she is taken captive, and basically there was a barter, kind of a slave system going around. I have that in the book that she, when the different groups and go into a larger camp, there are various captives around because this was kind of a trade going on at that time, and people would be there for a couple of months and then they would get ransomed or they would escape. It was kind of a regular thing, and so it is not like she was accepted and becomes a happy part of it, but she does start to become part of it, and especially once she has children, she never really loses her idea that she wants to escape and go back to her real life, which she thinks is her real life. And once she has her children, once she does get rescued, quote unquote, rescued by the 7th Cavalry, she doesn't realize how much she's changed until she goes back to where she started. And she realizes that, it was just fascinating to me to learn that the captives were not embraced when they came back, that they were kind of shunned, and they were considered spoiled. And so a lot of women were told, you know, it'd be better for you to die than to, you know, to make it through being a captive. And so that's just such an interesting human thing, like to actually think of a person who doesn't want to do that. And so, you know, and she doesn't, and she has to, she ends up not having a home in either culture.
Yeah. And why do you think the reaction was that to them?
You know, it's so much just like in any of the wars that they dehumanize the enemy. And so, I mean, when you read even the journalism at that time, it's just shocking, you know, how they spoke about the native cultures and trying to make them like they're less than human. And so having somebody come back from that culture and tell them, you know, these people are good people, these people have values, they, you know, as a culture, I want to be a part of that, or God forbid, choose that culture over the white culture, that is utterly shocking. And that's kind of where Josiah comes from, like, you cannot escape and go back there because it would humiliate us, humiliate me. And so that's so interesting. And so it's always, you know, Anne, against her will, gets to know the other in quotes, but that's just a kind of a commonplace, even nowadays in wars, that you do not humanize the enemy because, you know, God forbid that you could get along with them. So,
right, but she also experiences incredible brutality.
Absolutely. And that was realistic. You know, I mean, I saw Dances with Wolves like everyone else, and it's a beautiful story, but it's a fairy tale, and a lot when you read the actual, you know, the nonfiction, the historical documents. And I did, you know, I became friends with a couple of historians that wrote about that time period because I wanted to make sure that I was right. And they actually said, you know, you're kind of laying easy on the brutality. So I know from one perspective, I have people saying, oh my gosh, it's so incredibly brutal. But this was actually on the light side. I mean, you know, unless they captured a child, and then a child would be immediately adopted and would be considered a family member and they were safe. But an adult or a young woman, you know, that's kind of the way it was. And, you know, that's why you would not necessarily run off and join the tribes, because, you know, that was the fear. And so, I mean, you had to portray that. And she does make it through, though, and she does become part of the tribe, which did happen. And there was a couple of women that actually, you know, tried to write pamphlets, and they would write their narrative and their story saying, you know, I choose this life. This is, for me, it was a superior life, where they do fall in love with the person that they marry, and they want to stay in that life. And they tried to talk about it, that it was an okay thing, and that was totally rejected at the time.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Tatiana Soli about her latest book, The Removes. Now, there's another young woman who figures prominently in the book. She's one of the protagonists. That's Libby Bacon. Mm-hmm. Tell us about her.
When I started to write the book, I accidentally came upon a snippet about Custer that he started the 7th Cavalry because I was reading about it for Vietnam. And just reading a little bit about Custer, it was interesting. There was so much that I didn't realize. I kind of had the cliche version that everybody has. And then they talked about this 12-year passionate marriage that he had to Libby Bacon, and it seemed incongruous that Custer would even have a wife, you know, from what we know about him. And so just reading about her, she was a fascinating woman, and I guess she would be more somebody that we could all relate to because she came from a middle-class background. She was a judge's daughter. She lived in a small town in Michigan, and she was pampered, and you know, she knew nothing about going out onto the frontier and the territories. And so it was an interesting relationship that she and Custer had, and it was interesting how she kind of forced her way to go out and live this really rough life that somebody from her class level normally wouldn't do. And so, you know, she is a historical figure, and I found her fascinating. And it's kind of her reactions are kind of more accessible to the average person, that if this happened to you, how would you cope with living in these, you know, really desolate places and under these really difficult conditions?
And the conditions aren't just difficult because, you know, a war is going on, a brutal war of imperialist conquest, you could say, but also because Custer is not exactly an easy man to live with. Talk about their relationship and how she negotiates it, and even why she decided to marry him to begin with when she didn't think she ever wanted to get married.
So when I'm talking about their relationship in the beginning, they did know each other as children, and the Custer clan was kind of, you know, had a lot of children. Custer's father was a farmer. He used to be a blacksmith. They didn't have enough money, and so the boys were kind of wild. And so this is totally not Libby Bacon's family. You know, this is not the class lines. Even in a small town like that, she would not have anything to do with them. And so when they are, you know, I think she met him when she was 18 and he was 21 or 22 after a prolonged, you know, absence because he's in the Civil War. He comes back a national hero, and he was such a big hero, like he was a superstar of the time in a small town. And so she was literally swept away by him, and you know, he is known to have had a lot of charisma. I mean, I guess that was kind of his selling trait, and he was a hero during the Civil War, and so I guess she considered that. I mean, I guess when you fall in love, you fall in love, but she also considered that as an escape from living the small town life and getting married and settling down and having children. That was pretty much the only option for somebody at her level. So when they did go off, I think she maybe thought that after the Civil War he would do something else, but he was a soldier, and he did try to do other business-type things that never worked out. I mean, he was a soldier, and so when all of a sudden he announces that he's going to be where he was reassigned to the frontier and he decides to go, she goes with him. And she actually did know that he was a ladies' man, and he actually had, while they were courting, he actually was courting somebody else also. And it's interesting, Libby took it as a challenge, and she wooed him and you know, wanted to marry him. So I think they were kind of a well-matched couple. They were very passionate. They had a lot of very romantic letters that they would send to each other, and they got together whenever they could, and it was very interesting.
Well, there's one scene in the book where she discovers him in bed with a friend of hers.
Uh-huh.
And she has a very interesting reaction. Tell us what she does, and why did you write it like that? I mean, I assume you wrote it like that, that didn't... Was that something that
actually
happened?
Of course it's fictionalized, yeah. Of course it's fictionalized. I think it's interesting because, you know, it was open knowledge that he had had affairs with. So some of these forts were very, you know, a small amount of individuals there, and he would have an affair with somebody else's wife, and it would be known quickly. You know, everybody would know it, and of course Libby would know it too. And why she did not leave him, why she didn't go back home, she made the choice to stay with him. She made this choice to still have a real relationship with him, and there was a innuendo that she had had kind of a flirtation, who knows how far it went, with one officer while he was gone. And that was the big thing where he left his command, basically, after he got them into a position. And he took a train overnight to go see her. And he actually got court-martialed for that, for dereliction of duty, because he was so jealous. So they kind of had this thing. It wasn't she was not like just the wronged woman and suffering and staying at home. She kind of fought back a little bit, and so that scene was just kind of, you know, dramatizing her reaction. She did not have the reaction that you would expect from somebody of her time and place.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with Tatiana Soli, novelist and short story writer, about her newest novel, The Removes. Now, you have some other characters in the book. One I'd like to talk about in particular is Golden Buffalo. He's a young Indian who has had visions, or has visions that drive him into Custer's service. Tell us about him.
Obviously, I read a lot about the tribes, and they were they kind of at that point wondering how they were going to deal with this onslaught and how they were going to keep their, you know, cultures intact. There was the faction that wanted to, you know, fight till the end, and then there were the pacifists, and a lot of the pacifists said, we have to learn how to live in the white society so that we can, you know, thrive on our own and at some point in the future take it back. So I would say that they were not accommodation, like they were going to, you know, undersell their culture, but they thought that was the only way to survive. And of course, there was a lot of people saying, you know, that's being a traitor, that you're not, you know, really fighting for your people. So they had a lot of fighting within the different tribes of how they were going to deal with it. And Golden Buffalo does suffer. I mean, he is part of when Black Kettle, you know, thought he had a immunity from being attacked, and his tribe was actually massacred at the Sand Creek Massacre. And so he has that in his, you know, life, that he knows that you cannot trust the words that they're going to tell you. But he also, when he does get violent, he realizes that they are just going to really kill themselves. They're like dashing themselves on the rocks. They'd have no chance. And so he makes that choice to try to figure out, you know, what can I figure out from working with the enemy? What can I figure out to bring back? And so I there were people that did that. And he has, you know, a Sioux and a Cheyenne parent, one each. And so he's kind of a little bit between the cultures also. I mean, he's not totally rooted in one. And so I think he's the type of person who is able to make that movement out. And obviously, when you go out to get to know the enemy, you make friends within it. And so not that he ever becomes Custer's friend, but he comes to kind of respect and admire Custer. And there were a lot of the scouts that worked with him that did admire him, just on the level of being brave. That's one of the things that they valued, and also of being an incredible soldier. He had amazing abilities, tactical abilities and everything. He would always be in the front of any engagement. He would not be sitting in the back. I mean, they despise cowardliness. And so in a way, he's dealing with the enemy, but he comes to, you know, maybe not like the enemy, but comes to, you know, have a certain respect for them.
And he actually says that Custer has the heart of an Indian.
And that is a real quote by somebody.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Custer himself comes to regard him as a friend. Talk about the relationship between him and Custer and what that says, not just about these two individuals, but about the relationship between them in their respective social positions.
I think what I was saying earlier is how when you demonize the enemy, the people in the East that were running the policy of what was going on in the West, they did not know any, personally did not know any of the Native Americans. And so the people on the ground that were in the frontier, and they're actually working every day with the tribes, there are quite a few soldiers that actually sacrificed their careers because they said, we cannot, you know, do these policies, and this is unfair, and it is immoral. And so the people that actually get to know each other, they end up being friends. They end up having respect and understanding for each other. And so there were a lot of, this is, you know, obviously a fictionalized relationship because there was no golden buffalo, but there were lots of relationships like this with Custer, with his scouts. And he had, there were, you know, different chiefs that he would work with, and he would negotiate releases of hostages and everything. And he had this thing once, one time they had taken some chieftains hostage, and he would actually go there and, you know, sit down and smoke the pipe and have dialogue with them. He was very interested in the culture. He learned words. He got a teepee erected in his little camp, and he was just kind of more interested in the other. And of course, that's always essential. And if the people that were actually out there had been able to do the policy, it would have been so much less brutal. Of course, they couldn't, you know, unroll what was happening, but it wouldn't have been the lack of understanding.
And yet, he also killed Chief Black Kettle, who was killed at the Washita Massacre, by Custer. Chief Black Kettle, you mentioned him before, he was one of the pacifists who thought that the Indians needed to learn how to live within the white society. So, I mean, this is a very contradictory story. Custer, you know, we know him as the guy who massacred the Indians at Wounded Knee. So, you know, what is this like for Custer? I mean, I want to read a quote here from Custer, actually, which, you know, expresses one side of this ambivalence. The Indian cannot be himself and be civilized. He fades away and dies. If I were an Indian, I often think I would greatly prefer to cast my lot among those of my people, adhere to the free open plains, rather than submit to the confined limits of a reservation, there to be the recipient of the blessed benefits of civilization with its vices thrown in. I mean, what do you make of this?
I mean, that, I think that's what I was getting at when you have these people that are working out on the frontier in the territories. I mean, Custer admired that life. He would spend, you know, they would take a campaign out and he would be gone for months living in the wilderness. He had the soldiers, the cavalry especially, had that nomadic existence. So actually their lifestyle would mimic the Plains Indians, who were warriors and on horse, more than they would anybody like living in the cities of the East. So he felt like real kinship with them. I mean, he said he had never seen such incredible mastery, the warriors, you know, what incredible soldiers they were and how they rode a horse. He said, if I had a regiment of soldiers as good as they, I could win anything. And he is a warrior. He had the heart of a warrior, and so he admired them on that level. But he's also, he was basically, after the Civil War, he was, you know, demoted to a captain. He had to follow orders. There was no saying, I have a different opinion and being able to affect policy at all. The few soldiers that did that, and that was not Custer, by the way, because he was very interested in his fame and his career, and he didn't fall on the sword ever, you know, to do this. But if you had refused orders or something, I mean, you would be court-martialed and killed. There was not the policy of saying, you know, this is immoral and I am not going to do it. Could he have done better? Of course. What was interesting to me is that I knew nothing about Custer when I started this project, but there were a lot of leaders that were much, much worse than Custer. Custer's a relatively small cog in the story. He's famous because of The Last Stand, but in terms of what he actually accomplished, he accomplished relatively, you know, a small amount in comparison. He just became famous. Probably because of the long hair and his ego and all the pictures he had taken of himself. And that aspect of his personality was totally there. And I think that's because why we're all still talking about him.
Right. Now, you have historical photos and clips, like the one I just read, quotes from contemporary sources. Talk about the interweaving of fiction and fact, the way you did it, how you approached that, and what were some of the challenges?
I think it's interesting. I mean, just, I don't write only historical, but I write usually, you know, stuff that I don't know about. And sometimes when I come across some of these, like, just even on a character level, is looking, you know, when you think about Custer, he's kind of become a myth to us all. And when you actually see a picture that was a real person, it comes as a little bit of a shock. And when you actually look at newspaper articles and you realize how biased they were, it's kind of a shock to your system, and you realize that you're not just floating along on a story, but these are the real elements that were going on at that time. I think it's fascinating. I always think that it makes us look at our contemporary and the stuff that we're taking for granted now, and how, you know, somebody, you know, 100 years from now will say, how could those people actually believe the stuff that they were reading and the pictures that they're seeing and everything. And so it was really important to me. I want, obviously, to be, you know, caught up in the narrative and the stories of these people and really care about it on a fiction level, because, you know, I think that's the experience that I'm trying to give. But it's also interesting to actually be reminded that this was actually happening, and these are the type of opinions that were floating around at the time that these characters were reacting against. And when you're a writer, so I think I'm kind of taking away of the veil a little bit of being a writer by including it, but I think it makes it more interesting for readers to kind of make a judgment on what's going on if they really know what it was like, and not having it all filtered through the author. Obviously, filtered because these are my choices that I'm picking to be there, but hopefully it'll lead somebody to go on and do, you know, their own kind of reading nonfiction.
Yeah, and in what you're saying, you know, for example, one can think of in 100 years, assuming we last that long, people will look back on this whole revilement of immigrants with the same kind of feeling that we have when we look back on those who said that the Irish were, you know, no better than animals.
Totally. And that's what's so interesting. I think, you know, especially people in their 20s now, when they think about some of the, you know, the horrific events of the past, they think, you know, how was that even possible? And that could never happen now. And yes, it could absolutely happen now. And it's actually, you know, the people that refuse to let it happen. And so that's another interesting thing, is like, you know, who were the people back in Custer's time that could have said, you know, we are not going to do that? Obviously, there were very few of them, and they didn't have a strong enough voice to affect very much at all. And, you know, you could say at every big flashpoint in history, not enough people stand up. But it's like the taking for granted of the democracy. You know, people, until it's gone, they can't imagine it could be gone. So when you look back in history and see these things happening, it kind of, I think it makes you more aware of the time that you are in, and hopefully be more active, have a voice more.
Right. Well, Tatiana Soli, it has just been such a pleasure to talk with you about this wonderful novel of yours, your fourth novel, The Removes. Thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Tatiana Soli is a novelist and short story writer. We spoke with her back in 2010 about her best-selling debut novel, The Lotus Eaters. She's also the author of The Forgetting Tree and The Last Good Paradise. Her short stories have appeared in various venues and have been twice listed in the 100 Distinguished Stories in Best American Short Stories. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from her latest, The Removes. Next up, The Americas Before Columbus. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week marked Indigenous Peoples Day, a.k.a. Columbus Day. It's a good time to contemplate what was lost to the world when Columbus set foot on the American continent. So we dug for gold in our archives and came up with our 2005 interview with Charles C. Mann about his book 1491, about the Americas before the European conquest. Here's an extended excerpt from that conversation. Well, Charles Mann, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you come up with a radically different view on a number of issues than older views of the pre-conquest history of the Americas. Could you lay out some of those major differences?
Yeah, what I should say is it's not so much me. It's that, you know, if there's a contribution to my book, what I've done is visited a whole lot of researchers who have been working kind of isolation from one another and tried to say that when you add up all their work, it comes up to a complete new picture, in a way that sometimes the researchers themselves aren't aware of. So that, therefore, you have the whole new generation of scholars in Amazonia who are discovering that far from being a kind of an empty wilderness the way we've been taught, that the Amazon rainforest at the time of Columbus was teeming with people and, in fact, is largely a human artifact. But they didn't know, for instance, because that's not their field, that other historians have been completely reevaluating the way that we should look at the contact between the pilgrims and the various Indians in New England, who don't know that scholars have really done enormous new work on the Maya, which, some of which is just coming to light, who don't know that other people who are working in Peru who have made, you know, exciting new discoveries. And so I use the journalist privilege of hopping from one place to another to try and say that when you look at all these things together, the cumulative impact is even more than the impact that you have when you look at them separately. So some of the things that they found, for instance, just in the last couple of years, people have discovered that some of the oldest cities and the oldest urban complexes on Earth are on coastal Peru. They've learned that huge epidemics swept through the Americas just in the wake of the very first Europeans to come there, so that many of the colonists who reported wilderness were in fact seeing what the historian Francis Jennings has called a widowed land, a land that had recently been swept clean of most of its inhabitants. And they are also beginning to appreciate to what extent, and this is something that's particularly fascinating to me, that Indians completely reshaped the environments that they were in. They were not wildernesses. These were heavily managed landscapes, and often managed brilliantly.
Yeah, when you say that the Amazon is a cultural artifact, could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, first, there's all kinds of very interesting new evidence. It's really just emerging in the last few years that the rivers that go through the Amazon has many tributaries. The banks were lined with villages and towns that had extensive agriculture, but it's a form of agriculture that really is just being unraveled now. And it wasn't the kind of slash and burn that we're familiar with now. And the slash and burn agriculture, which is also sometimes called swidden, is when you chop down the trees in the forest, burn it down, what you've chopped down, and clear this area temporarily and plant something and get a few years out of it before the forest grows back. And what they've learned is that they've done something different that's sometimes called slash and char. You did cut it down, but you turned most of the wood that you got down into charcoal, stirred that into the soil, and for complex reasons that scientists are just beginning to unravel, that greatly improved the soil by providing kind of anchors for the microorganisms and fungi that are the soil ecosystem that is what makes soil really rich, and the typical jungle soil doesn't have much of because of the relentless heat and sun. And then, rather than planting annual crops, what they did was manage the succession. They planted orchards of kind of a peach palms and all the various nuts and fruits that we hear so much about from the Amazon. And you do this over centuries, and a significant portion of the Amazon, sort of low estimates are on the order of an eighth, high estimates are, half and even higher, of the Amazon is really the result of repeated plantings of orchards. So that it's what they call an anthropogenic forest, in which the composition of the species and the way that they're planted has been heavily regulated by human beings.
So, in other words, they could have stationary settlements there, is what you're saying.
Right.
That could support them, as opposed to the idea that they had to, that they deplete the soil very quickly and then have to move on.
Absolutely. And so the first Spaniards to go down the Amazon, which is the Orellana party and the Aguirre party, both their accounts reported that the banks were filled with, large towns, thousands of people. It was very dicey going down there, in fact, because the Spaniards were so outnumbered. And they would report that there would be, many, many miles of villages, without, as Orellana's, one of the Orellana reports said that there was miles of villages without one crossbow bolt between them, which is a couple hundred yards. And so in the mouth of the Tapajos, there is a very large city that in theory could have had as many as 400,000 inhabitants, although that seems probably too large.
And so that's Aguirre of Aguirre Wrath of God,
Werner Herzog. He was they were pretty bad guys. That the movie isn't exactly historically accurate, although it's a wonderful movie.
You connect some of these differences. Well, actually, it sounds like all along it's been a very highly politicized scholarship, if you can call it that, of the pre-conquest peoples here that's been done by Europeans, by whites. But you say that given the charged relations between white and native peoples, that the inquiry into Indian culture and history is inevitably contentious. And for example, you talk about the pristine myth and the ecological implications of some recent discoveries. I wonder if you could talk about that in specific, and then if you want, broaden that out too.
Well, sure. I mean, all history is politically charged. We witness the fights that we've had about should the American curriculum emphasize slavery, and, you know, should we teach the negative parts of American history, and you have these fights over historical standards. And then you add to that the very complicated issue of race and these different cultures, and particularly for Native Americans, which are, you know, very live and unsettled issues with, you know, strong feelings on both sides, you know, court cases, all this kind of stuff happening, and you ended up with something inevitably particularly charged. And one of the simple reasons is that we have been taught what they call the pristine myth. The term was invented by the geographer William Denovan of the University of Wisconsin. And a side effect of that is that, you know, if the countryside was a wilderness, then it's kind of okay to move in. It's very uncomfortable to think that the countryside is full of people. Now, there's a big fight also over kind of what you might call intentionality. Was this myth deliberately passed on to make Europeans and their descendants feel better? Maybe. It's clear that a lot of the Europeans who moved into the Midwest and West thought that it was pretty empty. And the reason for that was that they didn't understand what had happened about the diseases that arrived before them.
I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand, is that those diseases actually preceded the conquest, as you say, and killed, what, about 96% of
something like that. I mean, you know, this kind of figures are inexact, but I think there's a general agreement that they killed more than 90%, and some people believe, you know, up to 98%. Whatever the figure, it was the greatest demographic catastrophe in the history of humankind. Just a dreadful thing. So you want to, you know, have something so awful happening, you want to assign blame. It's very difficult because neither the Europeans nor the Indians that they contacted had the modern understanding of disease. Europeans, of course, understood contagion. They understood that diseases could be transmitted between people, but they didn't understand the mechanism. And in fact, basically, they understood that a disease could be transmitted, but whether it was, that was the will of God. And the Indians more or less understood it in the same way. They didn't, because epidemic disease was, you know, there wasn't much of it in the Americas. They didn't really have any kind of mechanisms of defense like quarantine or, you know, any kind of natural immunity because they hadn't been exposed to it. And so these terrible diseases would sweep through, and it was something beyond their experience. And they have also attributed it to the will of God. So you have two pre-scientific viewpoints there. And I'm not sure if guilt is the right way to think about this kind of stuff. Naturally, you know, our politicized environment, you know, that's what people want to do. And so when you talk about this, you know, people on one side of the political argument say, oh, you're just trashing Europe. And on the other side say, see, they were, you know, how awful they were. And I think that's imposing our own particular quarrels on people who have their own, you know, viewpoints and experiences. And it's much more interesting to try and say, well, how did they think about it?
And also just scientifically, is that because they didn't have a practice of domesticating animals, that they were so subject to the disease?
Yeah. Most of the really bad epidemic diseases, what they call crowd diseases, are animal diseases that have, you know, through a mutation, have jumped the species barrier and landed in people. And so smallpox came from, you know, camel pox or horse pox, the kind of thing that geneticists argue about. Measles is a variant on bovine rinderpest, which is a, you know, a cow disease. As we're starting to learn, human influenza comes from, you know, birds, especially ducks. So you have the bird flu that we're scared of right now. And Europeans and Asians lived around domesticated animals. In fact, they shared their houses with them. By a quirk of evolutionary history, there were very few domesticable animals in the New World, and the so-called New World. So you still can't domesticate bison the way you can domesticate cattle. And as a result, Indians just simply didn't live around animals the way that Europeans did, and those kind of crowd diseases didn't ever have a chance to develop. And in fact, if, you know, you can run this sort of science fictional, you know, alternate world that if that did happen and Europe and Indians had developed their own diseases, well, their lives would have been much more miserable. But when the Europeans came, the slaughter would have been two-way, and it would have been absolutely devastating for both sides.
And now I want to go back to something you said on the other hand of it, and that is that there's also part of this pristine myth is that, you know, the Indians lived in a kind of Edenic integration with nature. But you talk about some of the ecological implications of some recent discoveries. I wonder if you could tell us what they are.
The new perspective from, and this is mainly taken from geographers who have been trying to understand, you know, the broad scale changes in ecosystems over time, is that that Indians, like people everywhere, manage their landscapes. In many cases, they're extraordinarily successful at it. We have, you know, much to learn from them. The pristine myth is that they somehow didn't touch anything, didn't disturb anything, that, you know, people live were like these ghost-like presences. And there's a kind of a curious feeling to say about Indians that they're unique among all people on the earth, this kind of ecological patsies that didn't have any impact on their environment. It's a very odd kind of, I guess the academic term is essentialist argument, to argue that somehow these people alone had this essence that was different from everybody else. It's kind of creepy when you think about it. But what they are understanding is that these landscapes were thoroughly marked by the human presence. And the political implications of that are that much of, for instance, American environmental laws is animated by the idea that we should return the landscape to its pre-Columbian, you know, essence, which is seen as the wilderness. I mean, that's the idea of the Wilderness Act and so forth. And then to say, well, wait a minute, these landscapes are managed. Conservationists fear that this is, you know, opens the way for the bulldozers, so that developers can say, oh, this wasn't wilderness at all, therefore it's okay to pave it all. That's certainly, some people will argue that, but it also suggests to us that what we need to do is not so much to leave the land alone, but be very thoughtful about how we use it. And it's also, to me, it suggests a very hopeful idea that we can work with nature in the way that that they did and create something really nice.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Charles Mann about his new book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Yeah, there's a lot we can learn from them, and one of the things I loved about your book is how vivid you brought these people, many different peoples, many different cultures in the Americas, really alive. And I was fascinated by your description of how the Pilgrims must have appeared to the Massasoit Indians who were here in Massachusetts. Do you have the book with you? I'd just like you to read a short section of it. On the bottom of page 31 to the shopkeeper's peculiarities.
Okay. Would you like me to read that?
I'd love it.
Sure. Europeans have been visiting New England for at least a century. Shorter than the natives, oddly dressed, and often unbearably dirty, the pallid foreigners had peculiar blue eyes that peeped out of the masks of bristly, animal-like hair that encased their faces. They are irritatingly garrulous, prone to fits of chicanery, and often surprisingly incompetent at what seemed to Indians like basic tasks. But they also made useful and beautiful goods, copper kettles, glittering colored glass, steel knives and hatchets, unlike anything else in New England. Moreover, they would exchange these valuable items for cheap furs of the sort used by Indians as blankets. It was like happening upon a dingy kiosk that would swap fancy electronic goods for customers' used socks. Almost anyone would be willing to overlook the shopkeeper's peculiarities.
That takes place in 1621. I guess that's when.
Right. I mean, one of the sort of odd things, I'm writing a book about, you know, the Americas before Columbus, but one of the most valuable accounts we have are, of course, all the colonists' reports, the colonial chronicles after Columbus, by people who had not yet, you know, been changed much by contact. And so even though my book is before Columbus, there are bits and pieces of it that talk about, you know, things that came afterwards to try and give you an idea. They're windows into the past, I guess.
And that's some of the parts of the book that are so valuable, is to see that kind of confrontation of two cultures. You know, the native culture in this region that you talk about of New England really does seem, at the risk of romanticizing, to have been quite an improvement over that of the whites. I mean, for example, their attitudes towards children. You know, you say that the goal was to mold character. You didn't have any child labor. You know, the Indians thought it was quite peculiar the whole way that the colonists treated their children.
That's something that's very clear in the accounts. And the funny thing, of course, is that the Pilgrims and the Europeans came, thought that the Indians spoiled their children dreadfully by letting them have a childhood. And you see this again and again, this kind of disapproval. There's a book by the French historian Philippe Arius that's written about how the Europeans conceived of childhood, and they just simply didn't have the modern concept of childhood. And children were these dangerous creatures that had to be tamed and brought into society. And the Indians, to modernize, had a much more congenial conception of childhood. You know, there's so many things that that when you look at the old colonial chronicles, it brings you up short, because Europeans, our ancestors, were very different than us, and it's almost like looking at two very foreign populations, and their interactions are fascinating. And it's also fascinating to see that, to some extent, especially the Indians, I think, in New England, feel more modern, at least to me, than the Europeans were, my ancestors.
And actually, that's because we learned so much from them. One of the things that you talk about is how the concept of individual liberty, we took so much from that. In fact, what we think of as the post-conquest American character has so much to do with the Algonquin Federation. I mean, I know we went to school, in grade school, I can remember hearing how our Constitution is based on, or is it the Iroquois or the Algonquin, or is that
the same thing? The Iroquois, right, the Iroquois Alliance, which is actually a group of six Native American societies.
But it's more than just a constitutional document. It's a much more pervasive kind of influence that they've had on the American character. I wonder if you could talk about that.
This is an interesting issue, and it's very much a live political issue in tremendous dispute. But I think it's unquestionable that if you read colonial accounts, again and again, they're struck by the Indians' insistence, and this is in the Northeast, I should say, the northeastern groups, the Algonquin and Iroquoian-speaking societies of New England and a little bit further west and north, their insistence on personal liberty. The leaders of these groups, were not absolute authorities in the way that kings were, and they had to, particularly in the case of the Iroquois Confederation, they had to cajole their subjects. They couldn't do anything without the approval of their subjects. And they also did not have social classes in the way that the Europeans did. And it's quite striking to see how much their social attitudes then become like what Europeans complain about Americans in the 19th century. When your 19th century visitors come to the Americas, they're always complaining about how the Americans are sort of insubordinate, don't treat their betters respectfully enough, have this insistence on personal liberty. And it's also quite striking, if you draw a map, that the southeast of what is now the United States, the Indian societies there were very hierarchical and had a kind of slavery and eagerly participated in the slave trade in the southeast. And the ones in the northeast had nothing to do with it and refused to participate and thought it was an affront. And the tribal divisions on these lines pretty much mirror the Mason-Dixon line. And it's just a really striking thing. It's hard not to say, gee, these people lives were entwined for centuries. How is it possible that their attitudes did not have an effect on the colonial attitudes?
I mean, I always thought all men are created equal was an Enlightenment idea, but you could argue that it was an Iroquoian idea.
Well, it certainly was an ideal, and there's tons of stuff from the European political tradition that play into it. So this is a source of the American character, certainly not the source. But at the same time, I don't think you can underestimate the impact of having a model, a living, breathing exemplar of liberty walking around in front of you. And one of the things that's also striking is the continual complaints about colonists that, when things were going bad, when their society started creeping towards the authoritarian, colonists are peeling off and joining the Indians. And there is much more traffic that way. They could never persuade the Indians to come live in the colonies, but there's lots and lots of colonists, including some of my own ancestors, who at least temporarily peeled off and joined and lived with the Indians.
And in fact, colonists who became captives of the Indians tended to elect to stay with them.
Yes, and it was very difficult to persuade them to come back, whereas when the colonists captured Indians, they fled as often as they could. And there's a funny letter from Benjamin Franklin sort of scratching his head and lamenting this. Now, Franklin was really, no friend to the Indians, so obviously he respected them. But if you read between the lines, his letter, not very deeply between the lines, you have to see that these Indian societies just outside, you know, the next door neighbors, were deeply attractive to the colonists, to many people, especially on the bottom of the social strata, who looked there and said, I'd rather be free and not have to defer to these societies in New England.
I almost wonder if the Indians had an impact on the Enlightenment itself, on the ideas of Rousseau or Voltaire or folks like that.
Well, certainly the idea of the noble savage did, and that was a kind of a distorted view of the Indians, especially on Rousseau, but also on Voltaire and lots of others, who viewed them, you know, through a distorted lens, because they obviously didn't come over here and do anthropological studies, but viewed them as exemplars of human liberty. Now, they saw it as a kind of a primitive state, but I don't think there's any question, if you read this stuff, that the Indians and their example of another way of living didn't play a role in their thought.
A lot of it had to do with one man, kind of cross between George Washington and Jesus Christ, how do you pronounce his name?
Daganoweda.
Daganoweda.
Actually, there's sort of different Iroquoian languages, and his name, you know, comes out differently. But he was a very key figure in the, you know, in Iroquoian history. And the Iroquois were rough customers. I mean, even as I'm saying that they had these very strong ideas about human liberty, they were also, you know, extremely touchy about honor, about personal honor, and were prone in a way that makes you think of, you know, the Hatfield McCoys or stories about Sicilians. I don't know if the stories are true, but about if you insult my personal honor, this, you know, this is a matter of grave consequence, and a death may result. So these were people who were very, very fractious, and their history is full of accounts of you know, violence. And so bad did the violence get that eventually Daganoweda, the peacemaker, said, look, we got to do something about this, and through a lifelong campaign eventually succeeded in bringing together the Iroquois into this confederation that then became the greatest political power east of the Mississippi by the time of the colonists arriving, and were a formidable obstacle and one that both the British and the French tried to alternately deal with, get on their side. They were regarded, you know, as a substantial presence.
Right. And the progeny of a virgin birth.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. You know, as time receded, according to, oral history, Daganoweda lived sort of, you know, in the 11th or 12th century. And, over time, you know, all kinds of attributes were given to him. And so we see him as a kind of mythic figure, and in fact, enough of one that there's an argument about whether there was such a person or whether he's a kind of a stand-in for a group of people. In the same way that, the Trojan War, we know that such a war occurred, was there a Hector, was there an Achilles, or were they, you know, the sort of essence of a group of people, similarly with Homer. And so there's this past that, you know, clearly this thing happened, clearly there was a knitting together of these people into this confederation, which had a defined constitution, one of the earliest in human history and certainly one of the longest lasting. It still exists today. You can buy paperback copies of it. And this was something that loomed large to the colonists. Benjamin Franklin actually was an emissary at one point to negotiations with the Iroquois.
Charles Mann talking with Writer's Voice in 2005 about his book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with mystery novelist extraordinaire Tana French about her new book, The Witch Elm. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.